One of our former foreign ministers, Bill Hayden, had a good way with words. One of his better lines was this: in foreign affairs, words are like bullets. A vital insight that my next guest believes should be introduced into questions about Tibet and its 60-year-long battle with China. Well, he might even take issue with my use of the word battle. He'd certainly acknowledge that to the international community and thousands of pro-Tibetan activists and supporters, some of the celebrity kind, emotions have been sky high over Tibet for decades. That ever since March the 17th, back in 1959, when the Dalai Lama and his government fled into exile from their homeland of Tibet, the rights of Tibetans to follow their own traditions and run their own country instead of having Chinese overlordship has been one of the world's most edgy issues. It's claimed thousands of lives, including about 110 ghastly self-immolation protests since 2011, in an effort to persuade the Chinese government to let the Dalai Lama return home before he dies. But Dr. Robert Barnett, who's Director of Modern Tibetan Studies at Columbia University in New York and who's visiting Australia for a series of lectures, says the whole Tibet story is shifting and that it behooves people interested in resolution to take note and to alter their attitudes and, importantly, their words. He joins us now. Welcome.
Welcome to you.
Why do you say it's in large part a battle of words?
Well, we're looking at a 60-year we could call it an issue, a challenge that the Tibetans have posed to China. And those 60 years have included different kinds of challenge from the Tibetans. In the 50s, the Tibetans really posed the biggest military challenge that the Chinese ever faced since the founding of the PRC, at least within their borders. There were major battles that went on for several years before the Chinese were able to firmly get control of Tibet for their army. And then there was a long 15-year kind of guerrilla warfare period backed by the Americans when the Tibetans fought across the mountains from bases in Nepal. But what we're looking at now is really the failure of those efforts and the replacement of them by a completely different approach. This long 20 years we've seen of street protests by Tibetans inside Tibet and international advocacy by the Tibetans outside. The question is it working? And if it isn't, what are they going to do next? And this is what I am trying to draw attention to here. What a lot of Tibetans are saying is, what's the way forward, given that those previous two approaches haven't worked?
Well, you in fact suggest that outside misinterpretation, maybe inadvertent, fuel a lack of resolution, even maybe fuel violence, and that the conversation inside Tibet is now quite significantly different to that outside Tibet.
Well, I think it's partly an inevitable problem of language, and language is the key tool now. Because language has always been the key issue here. The Tibet issue comes out of a linguistic argument that has never been settled and should have been settled about what to call Tibet after the fall of the Qing Empire in 1911. It was clearly a country within a kind of Qing imperial formation in the 19th century. That empire collapsed. It was never ruled by China. It wasn't a part of China, but it was in the same empire as China. And then the Chinese claimed it as being part of their nation state when they were formed after 1911. Now, that happened to hundreds of countries around the world. That's a linguistic issue. Do you say that previous imperial colony or whatever you call it is now going to be an independent state? Or do you say it's integral territory of the new nation state next door? Or do you say it should be part of a federation? This is the debate. It's really the British, my own people, who failed to step forward and make a clear insistence that Tibet should be seen after 1911 as one thing or the other. It was left very vague. And this is what we're still seeing in the fight now. Well, now the Dalai Lama has decided not to go for independence, that he can't win that battle. And I think that's very pragmatic of him. But he's trying to call for the Chinese to accept autonomy, a greater autonomy for Tibetans.
Mm. But like the Basques are asking for.
Yeah, but much less violent.
We're asking for.
You were, yeah. And it's very similar to a lot of those demands, but it's actually much less than the Scottish are asking for, which the Tibetans certainly aren't allowed to. They'd certainly go to prison immediately if anybody in Tibet asked for independence. But it's become a battle over words, because what's happened in the latest phase of the Tibetan issue is that human rights has become the way of talking about it. It's an important way of talking about it. But human rights, when you talk about abuses that one one country is doing to another or to its own people. It's very easy for outsiders to run away with that language and start to overstate what's happening. There are serious abuses in Tibet, but they're not really very efficiently conveyed by the kind of rhetoric that we see outside. And this anyway produces a reaction in the Chinese. When they hear somebody criticizing them for human rights abuses, they say, how can you say that? We're bringing terrific modernization and airports and railways to these poor Tibetans. We're helping them. We're so generous. And then they see the Western or foreign criticism as old-style attempts to humiliate China. So it tends to backfire.
It prompts a completely, it's like an own goal, you're suggesting. It prompts a completely disproportionate, perverse response from the Chinese, which certainly doesn't fuel resolution.
That's right. And it's well intended, exactly as you said. And actually, it was astonishingly effective in the late 1980s, led to the Dalai Lama being recognized as a world leader in terms of peaceful propositions and getting the Nobel Prize. And it got him huge support for in the international community. And for a while, it really put the Chinese on the back foot, and they started to agree to have talks with the Tibetans. But it's never got them to agree to give any concessions to the Tibetans.
Well, in fact, you say Now that he has agreed to drop the call for independence, they're now actually upping the ante, you suggest, and saying, well, we want you to say it was never independent, the Tibetan state, which he can't surely agree to. So are they wedging him?
Yeah, well, I think this is another area where language becomes the key issue. The closer you move in settling a conflict to negotiation, which the Tibetans are trying to get to now, the more words become important and the more you have to be able to listen to the way words will be understood by your opponent. And what's happening with the Chinese is they gave three demands to the Dalai Lama about 10 years ago, which they said they would talk to him if he agreed that Tibet is part of China and stopped splittist activities, as they call them. And then they added it, increased those to five demands. And then it turns out that although he had given the concession they asked for, he said he would accept that Tibet is part of China, meaning now, they've now quietly shifted the goalposts and said they need him to say that Tibet was part of China. But they've never admitted that they've moved the goalpost. You would only know this if you're really reading the text carefully.
Can we go through relatively quickly the experience of various different groups, all part of your plea, really, for people to see how things are shifting? Inside Tibet itself, how would you now describe relations between the Chinese rulers and, say, average Tibetans?
Well, this is a really important question, and the real answer is we don't know. A Chinese scholar just came up to me after I gave a talk last night, in which I said that the one thing we're pretty sure of, among all the different questions we have to ask about what's happening inside Tibet and what people think, is that the Dalai Lama is hugely regarded as important, as a major leader by the vast majority of Tibetans. But a Chinese scholar told me yesterday he'd been to Tibet 10 times, and he concluded that the Dalai Lama's not important because all the people he met were young and spoke Chinese and were interested in modernization. So you can see here that for that Chinese scholar, if somebody's interested in modernization, they can't be interested in religion and the Dalai Lama. But actually, our impression is exactly the opposite. In the Tibetan society today, the two go together. An acceptance of the modern and a strong wish to have the Dalai Lama back.
But apart from that,
we don't know very much about what people are thinking.
But
we
can't get access. You do say that there's this very interesting revival, in fact, of Tibetan customs and rituals. Though there's been some cultural damage and erosion, ring-barking, as one Australian Tibet expert has once called it, the Chinese have encouraged, you know, a re-interest in certain Tibetan customs. So that doesn't quite fit what you've just said to me about the Chinese scholar.
Yes, we have a Chinese scholarly establishment, the hardcore, the more conservative establishment, who believes the standard Chinese rhetoric that what they've brought to Tibetans is the gift of modernity. Used to be in
as opposed to the medieval anachronistic ways of the old Tibetan spiritual establishment.
Yeah, and remember, if we'd been talking 30 years ago, the Chinese state would have been saying we're giving the Tibetans the gift of socialism, and now it's the gift of modernity and being part of a rising power in the world. So it's always seen from the Chinese side as generosity. But actually, Tibetans inside Tibet, they're using these opportunities, the modernity they get, to reinvent their own culture. You see extraordinary achievements in writing poetry, in making films, in artists, modern painters, literature, and people like that, and also important religious teachings going on. So there's a lot happening, and we can't say that the Chinese are trying to destroy the culture. That's just not true. But there are certain parts of the culture that the Chinese government doesn't like. Mm. And one of these parts is the Dalai Lama.
And what about the Tibetan diaspora? You say it's really now very split.
Well, they also have got themselves into a fight over words. And I think it's very sad, really, because they understandably, in a way completely correctly, they're divided between those who agree with the Dalai Lama's compromise that they should just ask for autonomy and those who feel that they should continue that mission that was very strong in the 60s and 70s and also earlier in the century to go for independence. And the two sides are battling this out on websites and in the media and in their community. It's quite a divisive split and it's a very difficult one to resolve. I think it's actually not a real argument. Independence is an ideal and autonomy is a practical policy.
I just wondered whether their identity was shifting, like whether, as often happens in these things, people who've been outside the country, it happened in Timor too, there's a big gulf between them and the people who've stayed at home. Is that happening?
Well, yes, it does seem to be the case. And there is some tension between those Tibetans brought up in exile and in many cases those who escaped directly from Tibet who are educated in Chinese and so on. And I think there's probably the situation will probably get resolved if the ones who are in exile can integrate and give primacy to the ones who come recently from inside China who know how to handle the Chinese. And then we may start to see if that's possible. That kind of internal reconciliation within the exile community, a new kind of thinking which makes the Dalai Lama's vision actually possible in practice.
And Dr. Barnett, you even take issue with the whole description that usually occurs in news bulletins and so on, where Tibet is described as a remote, isolated place, you know, virtually of no strategic importance, a matter of emotion, but not much more. An arcane dispute. You say this is actually not accurate either and doesn't help resolve matters.
Well, here I'm making a kind of intellectual point, which I think applies to the Chinese as well as us. The Chinese also think about Tibet and also that very troubled northwestern Xinjiang Muslim area that has now become a major site of terrorism in fighting for kind of independence. They see these areas as backward, peripheral, marginal, the borderlands, not really civilized and so on. I think it's not just us who think of them as mystical and remote. The Chinese do as well, and that means the Chinese don't put their best thinkers and best policymakers into thinking about this area. And that's one of the reasons they have such horrendous problems in those areas. But I think if we look at history and you look at geography, it's very common in countries that you assume that your capital and your coastline are the most important places where all the intellectuals are and all the businesses are, and this is what you should be looking at. But actually, a huge amount of history is driven by our hinterlands, by the vast lands that many of us have in our interiors or up in the north or wherever it is. It's true for my country, the British. A lot of our history is involved with suppressing the Irish and controlling the Scots, and actually that drives a lot of our society.
But in the
and
case
that's
of,
happening there
in Tibet, just before we go, it's the source of 9 of Asia's most important rivers: the Yangtze, the Irrawaddy, the Mekong.
Yeah.
It's warming very fast, and so the glaciers are melting. So and it's been the site of a big war with India in 1962. So this is not, you know, a little isolated pocket, is it?
Well, it has 2,000 miles of disputed borders between China and India, and the Indians have just announced that in response to Chinese militarization of those borders, that they're setting up a mountain strike force of 90,000 soldiers just to hold their defenses. So they consider this a live issue. There are talks going on between India and China, but this is a very live issue. And I think that, you know, as responsible citizens who all want our governments to pay attention attention to regional security wherever there are threats. Places like Tibet and Xinjiang, which are vast, they cover about 40% of China's landmass, are places we should always be paying attention to, not just looking at what's happening in the capital and on the coasts.
Well, Dr. Barnett, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
We'll watch our language. Robbie Barnett, Director of Modern Tibetan Studies at Columbia University, New York.